You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Jungle Deep. The podcast that explores the tropical lifestyle. Hello and welcome to the podcast, Jungle Deep. This is your host, Dr. Jones. We are on safari, and I'm here with you to learn, to have fun, and to explore the jungle.
We'll be right back, right after these messages. Stay tuned.
Petco, where the pets go. Petco, where the pets go.
Pet Life Radio has tail wagging, fur flying, fabulous deals for our listeners from Petco. Get $6 off your order of $60 or more and up to 40% off the entire Petco site.
That's right.
But that's not all.
Because you're a Pet Life Radio listener, you'll also get free shipping on your order of $49 or more. $6 off, up to 40% off,
and free shipping
from Pet Life Radio and Petco. To get these awesome deals, go to PetcoDeals.com. That's PetcoDeals.com.
Petco, where the pets go.
I'm not much of a reader, but I do wish I were more well-read.
There are so many great books coming out. I wish I could find a way to keep up.
Audible.com makes it easy to stay well informed and catch up on your reading simply by listening. Audiobooks from Audible turn downtime into uptime. You'll be more productive and become well read.
Now I'm able to catch up on all the great books I've been wanting to read.
With Audible, I feel smarter.
Pet Life Radio listeners, try Audible.com now and get your first 30 days of Audible Listener Gold membership plan free. And get a free audiobook. Choose from over 100,000 titles. To get this great deal, go to audibledeals.com. That's audibledeals.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Hello, this is your host, Dr. Jones. Thank you for joining me. I have a real treat for you today. Just a couple of episodes back, I commented on the fact that a prominent conservationist and lifelong rainforest expert and president of Conservation International commented online about the importance of the influence of Tarzan in his choice of career. His name is Dr. Russ Mittermeier. Said Dr. Mittermeier on his blog, quote, "Far more important than the impact of the Tarzan legend on my life has been its major role in bringing the jungle, now more correctly known as the tropical rainforest, to the attention of the world. In many ways, Tarzan was the first rainforest conservationist, protecting the forest and its animals against hunters, trappers, and other forms of exploitation from the outside world. He was truly a man ahead of his time. For myself and for many of my peers, Burroughs' works have provided so much more than entertainment. They have inspired careers that have helped to shape the modern conservation movement. These stories were an inspiration to many people in the middle of the 20th century who went into rainforest research and conservation as a profession." End quote. Well, when Dr. Mittermeier heard we were talking about him on Jungle Deep and were seeking his audience, he wanted to join in. Well, of course he did. If I may say so, as a primatologist, that's an expert on monkeys and apes, Dr. Mittermeier knows that the jungle is not only important, but it's fun, too. So just hours before boarding a plane bound for India, he graciously took the time to join us here on Jungle Deep. I am very pleased to bring to you today the interview with the President of Conservation International, Dr. Russ Mitterbhai. I have a special guest today, a real rainforest scientist and activist, President of Conservation International, Dr. Russ Mittermeier. And just hours from leaving to go to the other side of the world to do his work, he's making some time for us here on Jungle Deep. So I want to thank you, Dr. Mittermeier, and welcome you to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, I'm eager to find out two things from you today with what time we have. I first learned of you and your interest in Tarzan through a blog post that you did on the internet, and thought it was interesting that a man of your experience and focus relates to Tarzan. In fact, you said you found Tarzan to be an inspiration for you to get into this line of work. And we know that we've talked about this on the show before, that Jane Goodall feels the same way. And I thought, well, I'd like to talk to you and get your perspective on this. And could you start perhaps with just telling us a little bit about your personal history and how you got interested in the rainforest?
Well, yeah, sure. I grew up in the Bronx initially, and there's not a lot of rainforest in the Bronx, and not a lot of animals. But
no.
My mother was interested in animals. She was a housewife, but she really liked animals, so she would drag me all the time to the Bronx Zoo and to the American Museum of Natural History ever since I was a tiny little kid. And at about the time I was, I guess, 4 or 5, I discovered the Tarzan movies. And when she tried to enroll me in school in the Bronx, they asked me what my name was, and I said, my name is Tarzan. And the sister looked at my mother and said, is this going to be a problem, child? And I said,
we got a wild one here.
Yeah, I said, I'm not going to go to your lousy school if you don't call me Tarzan. And my mother dragged me aside and said, shut up and tell them what your real name is. But I was, very early on interested in it. And then when they finally let me in the school, they had a series of little interviews, and they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, jungle explorer, which, of course, was, again, stimulated by the visits to the zoo and the American Museum of Natural History and, of course, by the Tarzan movies. Then when I read the comic books as well, but then when I was 13, I discovered the book, both The Warlord of Mars, which is one of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars series, which is as good as the Tarzan series, not as many books, but quite good. The first book I got was Tarzan at the Earth's Core, in which Tarzan visits this prehistoric world at the center of the Earth. And that just fascinated me. I mean, it just combined all the things I was interested in. And to this day, I regard that book as the most influential that I've ever read in my life. And I read all of the Tarzan books, all 75-odd books that Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote, some of them wow. 5 or 6 times over.
Mm-hmm.
That together with the exposure to animals through the zoo and the museum really stimulated me to be a wildlife biologist. And when I moved out to Long Island when I was 9 years old, there were swamps and forests there. So I really got into reptiles and amphibians, collecting turtles and snakes and frogs and salamanders and things like that. And then started off in college at Dartmouth College in biology, but the biology course there was very pre-med oriented, people who wanted to be doctors. And I wasn't really interested in that. Mm. And so I shifted into biological anthropology and really got into primates. Of course, growing up where I grew up, there weren't many wild populations of primates. None, in fact, because there are no non-human primates living in the U.S. I started to, at age 19, I did a trip around Europe. First, I did foreign language and foreign study in Europe. And then I spent the summer, 3 months in 1969, traveling around Europe looking at zoos and really focused in on the primates. I decided that I wanted my career to be working on these animals that are the ultimate rainforest animals. 90% of all your 680-odd species and subspecies of primates are found in rainforests.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just focused my attention on those animals and continued that in graduate school.
Wow, so you've been on this path your entire life.
Absolutely. I mean, there was no question ever about what it was I was going to do. I was always going to be a zoologist, a jungle explorer. Biodiversity didn't exist as a word back then, but particularly a biodiversity specialist looking at the amazing diversity that exists, amazing diversity of life that exists on this planet, which is, after all is said and done, after all the probes to Mars and exploration of Moon and exploration of other planets in the solar system, it's still the only place in the entire universe where we know with certainty that life exists.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, now, you went to the Dum Dum, the big centennial celebration for Tarzan. Were there other conservationists there that you noticed?
Well, Jane Goodall was there because Jane Goodall also got her inspiration from Tarzan in part. But as she explained, that she read the books and then she went to the first Tarzan movie, her first Tarzan movie when I think she was 11 years old, one of the movies starring Johnny Weissmuller. And after 10 minutes or so, she walked out and said to her mother, this is not my Tarzan. This is not the image that I have of Tarzan. And she said after that, she never went to see a Tarzan movie because her image of Tarzan was very much in her mind and something that that inspired her without actually being connected to the movies at all, which is interesting. But yeah, she was at this event. She gave a keynote address. And I also went with my second son, Mickey, who's now 20 years old, and he's a sophomore in college in Florida. And he's also a Tarzan fanatic, perhaps even more crazy than I am. He also got into the books and the movies very early on. I think he knows more about Tarzan history now than I ever did because he's really researched it extensively. With all my kids, I have a daughter as well. I have a 27-year-old son, 20-year-old Mickey, and then a daughter, 16, Juliana. And when each of them turned 10 years old, I gave them an inscribed copy of this book, Tarzan at the Earth's Core, which was the one that had such an impact on me and which launched me into my career. But Mickey was with me at this dum-dum. He was just ecstatic. I don't think I've ever seen him that happy to see all these other people who just love Tarzan and who grew up on Tarzan and were just hardcore fans. He also met three Tarzan actors, Benny Miller, who was Tarzan in 1959, I think it was. He's in his 80s now, and he was super nice, and he's actually kept up with us since we met him. Ron Eli, who did the TV series in the 60s, and then Casper Van Dien, who did the last Hollywood movie about, I guess it's about 10 years ago now, not counting the Disney animated version. So he was just beside himself, and there was actually a film crew there from Germany that was filming a story about Tarzan, and they interviewed Mickey because he was the youngest person there because most of the people who are really into Tarzan are in their 60s or 70s, and they got into the books at about the same time that I did, going back to the early 60s. Johnny Weissmuller's granddaughter was there as well doing a film on her grandfather. And so Mickey was interviewed in both of those programs. So he was very excited. In fact, the German television crew even had him climbing trees for them because he's in very good shape. And he actually has a little organization that focuses on tree climbing as a sport. So he was very happy. So it's really something that's in the family. My older son, John, is a hardcore ornithologist, and he's been to 102 countries now.
Goodness.
He's done extensive research on birds in the rainforest.
Wow. So the Mittermeier family is really into the swing of things with Tarzan then.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think by now I've certainly seen more primate species in the wild than anyone else. I've really focused a lot on getting out and seeing these animals in the remote corners of the planet where they still exist and really focusing on their conservation because many of them are critically endangered or endangered now. And that's taken me to many, many different rainforest areas. So I think it's fair to say that I've probably been actually in more tropical rainforests now, more jungles than anyone else has ever lived. I didn't actually realize that until a few years ago, but I sat down and said, I've been to all these places on all the continents where rainforests occur and in most of the countries, and is there anybody else who possibly could have seen that many? And I decided more than likely not, unless there's somebody hiding out there that I don't know.
They'd have to do a lot of flying to do that.
Yeah, I've been now, my country count is up to 156.
Wow.
And many of countries, of course, are rainforests, whether they're on the major continents where rainforest occurs, whether it's in South America, Africa, Asia, or on many of the islands. You have a lot of rainforest on islands as well, like Indonesia, the Philippines, Madagascar, and many of the smaller islands that are out there as well.
Well, now I'm going to ask you what you've learned from all that in just a moment. But before we leave Tarzan, let me ask you, do you think Tarzan has a role to play? You know, he's been incredibly popular. And, of course, most people who have been introduced to Tarzan, whether it's through the books or through the movies or both, don't go on to become activists with rainforest conservation. But, you know, times are changing. And do you think Tarzan has a future in this work as a conservationist? Where do you see Tarzan going in the years ahead? What do you think might be possible for our favorite character?
I think Tarzan will continue to have a role. And if you look at Edgar Rice Burroughs' work in general, I'm very happy that they finally did a postage stamp for him, which was launched in Tarzana back in August. We were there for that celebration. There's a town called Tarzana in California that Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated has its offices in, which was actually created by Edgar Rice Burroughs, but I was very happy that he finally got recognition that he so deserved, because he's the greatest science fiction writer ever. I mean, he's much more popular than H.G. Wells or Jules Verne, and people who were, maybe they wrote better quality literature, but in terms of popularity and visibility, I don't think anybody can compare it to Burroughs. And he didn't do just the Tarzan series. He did a series on Mars, 11 books. He did one on Venus. He did the 7-book series on Pellucidar, which the prehistoric world at the center of the Earth, which arguably is the best of his series. I really am fascinated by that one. It was great that he was finally recognized as a great American author. Mm-hmm. But I think what's really interesting with Tarzan, which I really only started thinking about in the past year as this centennial was coming up, was the fact that Tarzan brought jungles, rainforest, to the world. Before that, the only people who thought about rainforests, who thought about jungles, were the explorer naturalists of the latter half of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. People went out there to hunt, to collect, to catalog the species that existed in these incredibly diverse systems. But in terms of bringing rainforests to the attention of the general public, it was Tarzan, absolutely. And I think that the interest that we have as a culture in these jungles, in these rainforests, can in large part be attributed to Tarzan and all the spin-offs and rip-offs and copies that that followed him. I think that Tarzan has had a great role. He goes through kind of periods of resurgence. I mean, I got interested in that period in the early 1960s when all the books were republished, and there was another surge with the Disney movie coming out. I guess it's about a decade ago now. And I understand there's another Tarzan movie coming out again. So I think the character has an incredible longevity. I think he'll be around for a long time to come, especially as these systems, these rainforest systems around the world, become more and more endangered and continue to disappear in spite of our best efforts.
Yep, I think you're right. Well, I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about that. How did you get involved with Conservation International? And can you tell us a little bit about what, you know, its purpose and its main activities?
In graduate school, I was a graduate student at Harvard. I studied non-human primates, in particular those in South America, in the Amazon region. I started out doing my field work in Brazil and then wound up working in Suriname, a little country to the north of Brazil, which has the highest rainforest cover of any country on Earth. It's about 90% still covered in rainforest. It used to be known as Dutch Guiana. In the process of going out and looking for primates that had never been seen by outsiders before, and also discovering several species new to science, I recognized that if you were going to work on primates, you inevitably had to work on rainforest conservation, because these animals were disappearing right in front of me. Their habitats were going, they were being hunted, they were going down the tubes, they were going extinct. I focused a lot of the attention of my thesis that I did in Suriname on the conservation aspect, interactions with humans, what was happening to primates overall. When I graduated in 1977, I got my PhD in 1977, I was hired by, first of all, I put together what was called a global strategy for primate conservation. It was the first time that anyone took a global look at what was happening to primates, and I basically came up with an action plan, what was needed, how much money was needed to achieve primate conservation worldwide. That came to the attention of the World Wildlife Fund, and they hired me to be director of their primate program in 1979. And so I worked at World Wildlife Fund for about 11 years, and then this opportunity came up to join Conservation International. It was a new organization that had been created by Peter Seligman from the Nature Conservancy in January of 1987. It was a breakoff group from the Nature Conservancy that decided to try a new tack, try to do something different in conservation. And 2.5 years into the existence of that organization, Seligman invited me to come to CI and be its president. He stayed on as a chairman of the board. I came with a strategy called the Biodiversity Hotspots. The hotspots, it's a concept that was invented by British ecologist Norman Myers back in 1988. And as soon as I saw it, I picked up on it and said, this is a brilliant strategy. I adopted it, and over the past 20-plus years now, I've been refining this concept, which basically says that biodiversity is important to all countries that have living creatures. Every country on Earth should do everything possible to conserve its biodiversity, but there are certain places in the world that are really, really more important than anywhere else. Places that have extremely high concentrations of endemic species found nowhere else, and places that are under a very heavy degree of threat, in some cases 80 to 90% gone already. So that's the essence of the hotspots concept, focusing on areas that have unique species found nowhere else, high levels of endemism, and are under a heavy degree of threat. Norman Iyer started out originally with 10 of these, and over several revisions over the past 20 years, I've come up now with 35. Mm-hmm. What remains in them occupies only about 2.3% of the land surface of the planet, and yet they have within them more than 50% of all plants and more than 40% of all vertebrates, mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, fish, as endemic species found nowhere else. And if you want to look at the most endangered species, those in the critically endangered and endangered categories of the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List, you see that anywhere from 80 to 90 plus, depending on the group of organisms, of the most endangered species are found in these hotspots. So it's really the tip of the iceberg. It's where the action is in terms of preventing extinctions and maintaining global biodiversity. If we fail in these areas, regardless of how successful we are in other places, we're going to lose at least 50% of the life forms that are out there. Using that strategy, particularly in relation to rainforests, because most of the hotspots are rainforest areas, places like Madagascar, the Atlantic Forest region of Brazil, the tropical Andes, the Philippines, Indonesia, places like that. So I've really focused on rainforests and also used primates, which are the most visible mammals in the rainforest, and use them as flagships, as symbols mm-hmm. for conservation of rainforest systems.
We'll be right back, right after these messages. Stay tuned.
Every pet is unique. Maybe they're gray in the muzzle, yet young at heart. Maybe they're growing out of the puppy stage and into their paws and ears. Or maybe they're just trying to maintain a more girlish figure. At PetSmart, we have the right food for your pet at a great value for you. PetSmart. Be better together.
Go to PetSmartDeal.com and save up to 30% on pawsome gifts for the pets and pet people in your life. Toys, collars, leashes, PetSmart gift cards, treats, and more. Go to PetSmartDeal.com today. PetSmartDeal.com.
Dyson.
The new Dyson Animal Vacs are powerful bagless upright vacuums for homes with pets.
Air muscle and radial root cyclone technology generates the strongest suction power to powerfully remove dust, dirt, and pet hair from the home or car.
To order your Dyson Animal Vac, go to DysonDeals.com. DysonDeals.com to order your Dyson Animal Vac today.
Dyson, music to your ears.
This is Dr. Jones. I invite you to visit a website to learn about a tribute underway for one of the world's most beautiful natural places, Yosemite National Park. Masters of their craft, the Polsons are creating gorgeous murals of stained glass representing the four seasons of Yosemite, and their project is soon to be a campaign at Kickstarter.com. You can take part in this historic art project and participate in the creation of this awesome exhibit honoring Yosemite. If you love Yosemite, you will love the Four Seasons of Yosemite. Learn more at www.williampolson.com. That's William, W-I-L-L-I-A-M, Polson, P-O-U-L-S-O-N.com.
Hi, this is Ken Jones from the Prince of Ponds podcast. The frogs are shaking the shakers, the turtles are hitting the slapsticks, and the koi are blowing the trumpets. It's party time here at Prince of Ponds. Out under the swaying palm trees, the pond fairies are kicking up their heels and spinning into light in the twilight. Here on Pet Life Radio, it's time to celebrate the magic of ponds, waterfalls, fountains, and water gardens at the Prince of Ponds podcast.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Now, more of
Jungle Deep, Deep.
And so what does Conservation International do? I mean, obviously, you've done a lot to identify trouble areas and where we need to have our priorities. Then what?
Well, Conservation International has basically done everything that you need to do to get the job done. to put it in a nutshell. And we have offices in about 25 countries. We've given grants, supported projects in more than 70 countries through a variety of funding mechanisms that we have. But we work in the field with the creation of protected areas, protection of species, working with local indigenous and other local communities to empower them. We work with governments to make sure the right policies are in place. And we have a large amount of work going on with corporations to make sure that corporations do the right thing. And you are finding now that the corporate sector is becoming more and more responsible. I mean, not everyone is there yet, but many corporate leaders are now taking on much more responsibility and interest in conservation issues. And ultimately, we're also demonstrating that conserving biodiversity, what's now being called natural capital, conserving this natural capital is really the most important ingredient in long-term sustainable development. If we try to develop without conserving our living natural resource base, our renewable natural resources, we're going to fail, ultimately. And I think that in the series, this was a big meeting for international conferences. We had a meeting in Gaborone, the capital of Botswana, hosted by the president of Botswana, who's one of our board members, in which we got 10 African countries to sign on to a thing called the Gaborone Declaration, in which they committed to really looking at natural capital as being central to their development. That took on an even bigger role at the Rio Plus 20 summit in Rio de Janeiro in June, which was the 20th anniversary of the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, which was, in my opinion, the most important environmental meeting ever. And we had about 60 countries and almost 90 corporations signing on to a declaration with the World Bank saying that natural capital needed to be central to sustainable development. Now we just had the meeting of the International Union for Conservation of Nature in South Korea just a few weeks ago. Again, this issue came to the fore. And now I'm going to India for several weeks for the Biodiversity Convention, which is the international treaty, kind of the overarching treaty that deals with biodiversity and all of the related issues that come under the banner of biodiversity conservation. So CI is very much engaged in developing concepts and putting them to test in the field to make sure that they're not just theoretical, they're not just nice study papers that wind up on somebody's shelf and don't get used. And we work in some of the highest priority countries on Earth for conservation, Brazil and Indonesia, which are the two richest countries for biodiversity, and places like Madagascar. And for primates, Brazil, Madagascar, Indonesia, and Democratic Republic of Congo are the four countries out of 91 countries that have wild populations of primates. Those four account for about two-thirds of all species. But these countries are globally for many other things as well, in addition to their importance for primates. So we work in many of these high-priority tropical countries to ensure that there's field programs in place, that protected areas are where they're needed, that local communities are benefiting and human well-being is achieved, that governments are doing the right thing, that the corporate sector is doing the right thing, that all of these ideas are amplified through international conventions and treaties and higher level activities that around the world.
Well, it seems to me really clear that over the last 20 years or so, we've really come a long ways as far as raising the consciousness of corporate leaders and government leaders about this concept of sustainability, about protecting our resources and conducting our business in a way that can continue, where we don't use up and destroy our natural resources. Everything you're saying sounds like kind of endorsing that. Do you feel that's the case, that we've come a long ways and this is now a part of every conversation about progress in these various countries around the world?
Well, we've come a long way, but we still have a lot more to do. I mean, the word sustainability and sustainable development as a concept have been much used in the past 30-plus years, ever since the World Conservation Strategy that was put together back in 1980. It was not until this year that we really started to get global recognition of the fact that the environment is not just a consideration in sustainable development, but it is the central consideration, it is the most important element that we need to recognize and value for its full worth, and not just see it as a marginal issue. And I think if we can fully integrate that into the way countries and corporations do their income accounting, national income accounts, corporate income accounts, recognizing the true value of tropical forests, oceans, freshwater, other living systems, then I think we will have really made big progress. But right now, still in many places, if you look at a rainforest and somebody, and you value it at zero, and somebody comes in and wants to put in an oil palm plantation, it looks like a good deal. But if you look at all of the services, freshwater, carbon sequestration, the values of the biodiversity, the foods and fibers that are extracted by local people, if you really look at that full range of values, then that standing forest is going to be worth much more than an oil palm plantation. That's the kind of thinking that we really need to integrate into the international community as we move forward.
And what effect has it had on rainforest conservation or rainforest destruction at this point? Are we slowing it down? We're certainly preserving various areas here and there, but what would you say is the status of rainforest destruction at this point in time?
Well, I like to look at it country by country and region by region. And globally, there's still a lot of problems, but there have been a lot of success stories. The Amazon region, the Brazilian Amazon, for example, which is the largest block of rainforest in any single country, more than 50% of that now is under some form of protection. The state of Amapá in the northeastern part of Brazil, northeastern corner of the Amazon, that's an area about the size of New England. It's 73% covered in protected areas of various kinds and indigenous reserves. So that's a target that we're really looking at achieving. Countries like Suriname and Guyana, they're doing a good job with protection. Suriname's more than 90% protected. Guyana's more than 80% protected. And they're looking at strategies for developing low-carbon development, green economies. So that's very positive. On the other hand, you have places like Madagascar, which has got arguably the highest priority biodiversity hotspot on Earth. It's more than 90% gone. It has a government that took over by coup in 2009 and is still not recognized by any other country. And 90% lost. What remains is incredibly important globally, and yet we're having difficulties getting achieving our objectives there because of the lack of a functioning government. We have to work almost exclusively with local communities, and that's had a positive effect, but we still have a long way to go there. And the Philippines is down to probably under 5% of its remaining forest cover. So there are some real challenges out there still. West Africa, the countries of West Africa also very heavily impacted, not just by forest destruction, but also by bushmeat hunting of wildlife, primates and other animals as a source of food, not subsistence food, but actually a luxury food item. So there's a lot still to do. So there are no final victories in conservation. You have to continue working. You have great successes, and then you have setbacks. You just have to keep on moving forward with a spirit of optimism that you can get the job done.
That's so well said. I really appreciate what you said there and the overview of what's happening around the world. That's the most concise report I can imagine, and I do appreciate that. I know we're going to wrap this up here in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you, what part does the public play in this? What part does public education play in rainforest conservation? And then to get more specific, do you have a message that you most would like to get across to our listeners?
Well, public participation in all this is absolutely essential. And we now have, through the Internet, more capacity to reach out globally and to achieve levels of interest and participation that we didn't have when I started in this business. And not even close. I mean, we're looking at several orders of magnitude more capacity to have penetration in this day and age. And the younger generation is so attuned to using this network of communications. I mean, all of my children are on Facebook and Twitter and everything else, and I see the enormous potential of that. On the other hand, kids are getting more and more into the digital world and kind of forgetting about the natural world, so we have to keep getting it out there that, hey, the natural world is really fascinating. You really should go out and see it. And what I say to people in this country and in Europe and the developed world in particular is get out and see it. It's so easy now to go on a trip to see a rainforest somewhere. Encourage your parents, if you're a kid or if you're an adult, go out and actually see it. And once you've gone and seen it firsthand, you become so committed. You become really part of the converted, and get your friends involved. Get everyone involved in this. Recognize that you're not going to solve it all just by recycling and taking shorter showers. That's important, and you need to do that. But the problem is really global, and if we let the rest of the world deteriorate and we do a good job with conservation here in the U.S., ultimately it's going to turn around and have an impact, a very negative impact on us. It's a global problem. We need to deal with it globally. We need to all become global citizens and take on, you don't have to try to take on the whole global issue all at once. Pick out a piece of it. Now, let's say you like lemurs in Madagascar. Try to work to conserve lemurs, support conservation organizations that are doing it. Go out and see it. Get your friends involved. We need to have much more participation, especially leadership from countries like the United States, this is the most powerful country in the world. We should really be taking a leadership role at a government level, at a private level, corporate level, and at an individual level as well.
Well, that's terrific. I thank you very much for that and for your time today. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have too. And for those that want more information, do you have a website you'd like to share or some contact information for us to learn more about these things?
Yes, please go to www.conservation.org and find out more about our organization. And through that website, you can also connect to our primate specialist group website, which is part of the Conservation International website, if you want to learn more about primates in particular. I'm trying now to stimulate the sport, the hobby of primate watching and primate life listing, the way the bird watchers do. I'm very inspired by the bird watching community. $34 billion industry around the world gets people out into nature all the time. And I'm trying to actually push primate watching now as a hobby or as a sport, a competitive sport as well.
There's an idea. That's great.
Yeah,
and so that's conservation.org.
Yes, conservation.conservation.org.
Terrific. Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Mittermeier, for joining us on the Jungle Deep Show and sharing all that information with us. It's been a fascinating segment, and I so much appreciate your time. I know you're off to go to the other side of the planet pretty soon here.
I'm Monday evening. I'm flying to Hyderabad in India, which is the site of this meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity. We'll be there for about 10 days, and also going to try to get out to some field sites to see some of the nature of India. I've been to India 5 times before, but it's fascinating country, and there's still a lot to see, so I'm going to try to go out and see some other wildlife there.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. Well, I hope you'll come back on the show again and give us an update on what's happening and what you've been up to. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
All righty, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Be sure to share Jungle Deep Podcast with your friends and coworkers. You can see beautiful photos and learn more about Jungle Deep at our website, calaverasgold.tv. Now that's Spanish, Calaveras, C-A-L-A-V-E-R-A-S, gold, G-O-L-D, like the mineral, .tv, like television. You gotta check it out. Where else can you go for this kind of fun? Just click on the Jungle Deep title in the header directory. Our show notes pages have valuable links for you. I invite you to email me at jungledeep@calaverasgold.tv and follow me on Twitter. Search for Jungle Deep or KenJones56, all one word. I would love to hear your ideas for the show. Well, the show's over for today, so it's time to refill my Mai Tai, mount my elephant, and head back into the jungle.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.